This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I've been working with a nurse dietitian for the last 6 months, and it's been life-changing. I've lost weight, healed my relationship with food, and have way more energy. Working with a dietitian online to create a personalized nutrition plan was so easy thanks to Nourish. The best part? I pay $0 out of pocket because Nourish accepts hundreds of insurance plans. 94% of patients pay $0 out of pocket. Find your dietitian at usenourish.com. That's usenourish.com.
Legacies shape who we are, but who's shaping them? In the new season of Black History Year, we're breaking down the meaning and power behind the personal, familial, and systemic legacies that define our world. We're diving deep into how political and cultural forces have historically molded Black communities and what it means for our future. Join us on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts for a new season of Black History Year. Let's shape our collective memory and legacy together.
Welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan. This week, we've got a great edition of the show. It's Heart Health Month in February, and Sheena Fannin, who's an American Heart Association volunteer and advocate for the Go Red for Women initiative, is our special guest. She's got quite the story. But first, our Odyssey conversation entitled Big Games, Big Money. Next.
The big games have only gotten bigger, and the money in sports has only gotten bigger. I'm Odyssey News reporter Dave Cohen. This is Big Games, Big Money, an Odyssey conversation. To get to the biggest games, teams often need big-time stars, which can mean the highest-paying contracts to attract and keep those superstars. The past two baseball off-seasons have brought the two largest professional sports contracts in history. 10 years, $700 million for Los Angeles Dodgers superstar Shohei Ohtani last year. And it took just 1 year for that record to be broken this offseason by the New York Mets, signing Juan Soto to a 15-year, $765 million contract. In fact, five of the 10 most valuable contracts in the world are held by baseball players. Only one NFL player is in the top 10, and that's Patrick Mahomes. The Kansas City Chiefs quarterback is represented by longtime agent Lee Steinberg. Lee, can you take us inside how these contract negotiations work?
Well, when I began, there was really no organized field in 1975 of sports agency. As a matter of fact, teams could refuse to deal with agents and just click the phone down because there was no guaranteed right of representation. So that unionization came later, and the right of recognition. When I began, the teams in the NFL got $2 million per year from their national television contract. The two franchises that came into the league in 1976, Jacksonville and Seattle and Tampa Bay, had a purchase price of $16.5 million. Today, the Dallas Cowboys are valued at $10 billion. Today, teams get closer to $300 million per year in the NFL from the national TV contract. When I did Steve Bartkowski's contract, which was the biggest rookie contract of all time back in 1975, the total package was $600,000 for 4 years. And he got a signing bonus of, wait for it, $250,000, and it made headlines. And his first year salary is $40,000. There were no cell phones. There was no computers. There were the world as it existed has massively changed since then.
It wasn't that long ago where $3 or $4 million contracts was big. Now there are contracts up in the $40 million per range. How much has the business changed throughout your career?
So, first of all, understand that most of this financial explosion in salaries is being driven by record-breaking television contracts. And what happened was networks realized that by spending loss leader economics, more money on rights fees than they could ever recoup in advertising, they had a captive audience on a Sunday afternoon, for example, to watch all the promos for their Monday through Friday programming. So when Fox jumped into the bidding years ago, it was a marginal network. But at the end of getting the NFC package, they became the number one ranked network. And CBS, which lost the package, went to fourth place. So it had to do with Monday through Friday programming and the bottom line value of the network. So that exploded. So negotiating, it's important to understand the revenue structure, how luxury boxes and premier seating and naming rights and all the flow of money comes into it. And in football, they take all the revenue that exists and they cut it into 53% share for owners and 47% share for players. And so then there's two ways contracts get negotiated. One is for rookies, and largely now we have salary caps in both football and basketball. And those salary caps are slotted so that there really is very little negotiability to it. If a player got drafted number 15 in the first round or number 37 in the second round, the team's going to pay all the money that the salary cap authorizes them to pay. So what used to be long holdouts in both those sports have gone away. Now, for a veteran, the question becomes comparables. So it's a matter of understanding the market. How does this player compare to other players in terms of years of service, in terms of starting games, in terms of statistics, in terms of team success? And it's finding a statistical way to compare him to other players. And so the negotiations take place using other player contracts as the market. And the big opportunity in every sport is free agency. Because when a player becomes a free agent, they get the benefit of competitive bidding. It's not a draft pick with no options. It's the ability to first sit a player down and you say, what really is critical to you in the world? Is it short-term economic gain, long-term economic security, the geographical location, the ability to be a starter, the quality of coaching, that the team is winning? And that value system will fit different for different people. Years ago, I had Tim McDonald, who ended up strong safety for the 49ers, and he was a free agent. He said, you know, I really want to go to a winning team. I haven't been a winner, and my family's in Fresno. So 10 teams came into the mix, but when the 49ers showed interest, he said, there we go, get me the best deal from them, because they were a winning franchise and they were the closest to Fresno. So it's a matter of in football, B-plus players get A-plus contracts.
Can you take us inside how these contract negotiations work?
Are extended and have their contracts redone before they ever get close to free agency. A franchise quarterback, for example, is almost always going to be extended. And an extension means an additional bonus for the current year, keeping that salary, and then plotting out a number more years.
There are players who just want to be shown the money, but there are others who want to be near one city or close to family. You, of course, want to make as much for your clients as possible. How do you handle a player who wants to give a hometown discount to be where they want to be?
That's fine with me. Basically, the role of an agent is to try to fulfill the player and to listen carefully to who that person is and what becomes a solution for them. So the truth of the matter is, all of the economics are pretty stunning. So if someone says, well, I'm going to take $23 million instead of $26 million, $23 million is still a lot of money. And so I want that player to be happy. It may be who the coach is. It may be the system they play. It may be the teammates around them. It may be winning is critically important. And, you know, as we come up to a Super Bowl, the ramifications of being a Super Bowl player elevate those players into becoming household names so that ultimately players are hyper-competitive and they want to win.
With the range of salary cap types in different leagues, are the super teams a good thing for sports?
Well, my childhood team is the Dodgers, which is obviously a prime example. But remember that what the Dodgers did, they marketed Los Angeles in the 1950s when they came like it was Des Moines, Iowa. And they had AAA nights and straight-A student nights and Gowanus and Rotaries. And the concept was coming to a Dodger game. So part of what gives them that financial ability is the fact they sell out every night. And any team has the capacity to do that. I think it's positive for sports to have super franchises that people can aspire to. I think that dynasties, now I may be a little biased because I represent Patrick Mahomes, but I think the Kansas City concept is admirable. And the way they win is ownership with the vision and the ability to hire the right general manager and coach. And it's an executive who's got a concept and a plan. And if you really want it, and a coach who can execute it, and then stability. So they have all these parity-making concepts, but they're never going to replace inspired ownership, front office, and coaches. And in a sport like football, you can see it with Dan Quinn going to Washington and taking a team that was essentially moribund and making it a playoff team, and Sean Payton going to Denver and Jim Harbaugh going to the Chargers. And you can see if they wanted to have a draft, they ought to draft coaches and executives and owners.
All of the money that we see in sports, the huge TV deals, the huge contracts, we know that it ultimately trickles down to the consumer. How do these big contracts impact the average fan?
Throughout my career, I've always said that we need to seed and nurture a new generation of fans for each of the sports. And it would make sense to allocate, like, for the 49ers stadium, 10,000 seats that are distributed to working people and kids, and to make sure they have access to the game. Then by the end of the year, you have 100,000 people in a market who have at least gone to the games and seen them played live. Now, I want to disabuse you of the concept that ticket prices and salaries run together. They really don't. Ticket prices are a function of supply and demand. And in my early years, I used to say to owners, look, we'll take a 10% reduction if you lower ticket prices. And they said, don't bother, because ticket prices are how many people in the Bay Area want to see the 49ers, and at what point when they raise prices can they no longer fill the stadium. If you take a bar graph on the expansion of salaries, it relates directly to television contracts, but it doesn't relate to ticket prices.
With that supply and demand affecting ticket prices, we go to Detroit, where Odyssey News reporter Tim Pamplin finds fans feeling the jump in demand there.
Long-suffering Detroit Lions fans had a glimpse at glory, a season like no other.
Franchise record 14 to franchise record 8-0 on the road. Franchise record.
The team breaking NFL records both on the field and off.
Most expensive ticket I saw in the secondary market, $8,055 for two seats at the 50-yard line.
Ticket prices for the Lions playoff games hit the stratosphere, yet every single game, the Lions sold out their 65,000-seat arena.
Everybody, touchdown Lions!
The fans, well, they did whatever they could to get in the Lions' den.
I actually opened a credit card just for this team.
For James Ness, who travels up from Indiana, he lives for his Lions.
2 hours sleep. I work Saturday nights. I get off. I get home at 3 a.m. I'm on the road by 8. No matter what. It's my heart. That's all. It's just my heart.
These games can feel like they're everything when you're at the game, and that escapism can feel really good.
Hi, I'm Dr. Marla Bartoy. I'm a clinical psychologist at Wayne State University in Detroit.
She says the reasons why fans accept the price increases are many.
People have what they call FOMO, that fear of missing out. They're worried that they're going to miss something really historic or important, and they won't have that chance again if they don't go this time.
While the Detroit Lions fans are still licking their wounds after being eliminated from the playoffs, they're learning their season tickets will be going up 38% next season.
There's so many people I've heard that have had tickets for 50 years, you know, that are on Social Security or whatever, and they just can't afford it. And I'll be honest with you, it breaks my heart.
As the prices of the games continue to skyrocket, there's concern that the stadiums will become inaccessible to so many, thereby changing the actual dynamics of the game.
This has been Big Games, Big Money, an Odyssey Conversation, produced by Michelle Fredrigill and Dennis Foley. You can get the best in news, sports, and talk from your favorite radio stations like this one and more content like Odyssey Conversations anytime, anywhere on the free Odyssey app. For all of us at Odyssey News, I'm Dave Cohen. The big games have only gotten bigger, and the money in sports has only gotten bigger. I'm Odyssey News reporter Dave Cohen. This is Big Games, Big Money, an Odyssey Conversation. Professional sports has become a huge industry, one valued at the tens of billions. Andrew Brandt is a former agent, former Green Bay Packers executive, and is now a professor at Villanova University. He joins us now. We have seen astronomical growth in the dollars associated with sports. Now, have things changed in the past three decades or so? And what has been driving that change?
Yeah, I mean, there's extraordinary revenue coming into sports. And the primary driver of that, as everyone knows, is media. Media is the lifeblood of sports. And if you sort of trace the popularity of sports, you can trace the popularity of media, where at one point it was just sort of three television stations. Then the cable explosion, then the regional sports networks, and now we have streaming. And all of that has craved sports because it's the only live television besides news. It just is such an emotional appeal to people. And sports programming in any kind of media is a recession-proof. It's a winner.
What about the collateral economic impact of all of sports money? How big a role does sports play in economic life of cities, stadiums, merchandising, attracting tourists, and the like?
Yeah, you get different answers here, especially this comes up a lot when we talk about building new stadiums, building new practice facilities, renovating stadiums. I can speak from my experience. A game day weekend in Green Bay, where people set their watches to the games, was roughly $15 million to the Green Bay area, which is a small city, as everyone knows, 100,000 people. That's a big number. If you extrapolate that out to bigger cities, you can sort of go from there. But yeah, it means a lot to these communities to be a major league sports city. Beyond the economics, of course, psychosocial value and having a big league team, whether in any of the sports, especially NFL.
The Super Bowl may be the only television event where people tune in to actually watch the commercials. So we sent Odyssey News reporter David Welch to one major marketing firm to see how all these ads get done.
I've never been to an ad agency, and my gut tells me most of you haven't either. In general, I've always considered them sort of a secret, the kind of place where the special sauce is made using a recipe guarded by a select few. So when the folks at Goodby Silverstein & Partners offered a glimpse behind the curtain, I jumped at the chance. And when they said I'd be meeting with Chief Creative Officer and ad guru Margaret Johnson, let's just say I was excited.
The fourth floor and the third floor are our creative floors.
GSP is known for their Super Bowl ads, and that's primarily why I'm here. But if I'm being honest, there's another question. Up front, I really want to know, do their offices resemble anything close to the TV show Mad Men?
Well, we're not smoking and drinking in our offices, so it's a little different.
They are, however, cranking out some of the world's most watched and most expensive ads. GSP works on several Super Bowl campaigns, including ads for Doritos, Mountain Dew, and this particularly memorable BMW ad featuring Christopher Walken.
Nice ride.
It's the real deal. 100% electric.
It's the real deal.
Johnson says developing campaigns involves a lot of work, but Super Bowl ads are a year-round affair.
There's so much work that goes into these things. A lot of times, as soon as the Super Bowl is finished, we're starting working on next year's Super Bowl.
Johnson has a way of turning a complex process, ads are little movies, their visual expressions, their psychology experiments, into something that seems almost simple. She says a good Super Bowl ad needs to cut through the clutter. And she says it's important to remember that most of them are being watched in the midst of a party.
And it's super loud, and they're drinking, and they're distracted.
The recipe they use for rising above all of that includes a straightforward message coated with a thick layer of humor, and their portfolio shows it's a formula that works. Ads they've made for BMW and Doritos have won plenty of awards, and they continue to be some of the most memorable spots featured during the big game.
You know that Monday morning, everyone is going to be talking about the ads on the Super Bowl, and you want to be a part of that conversation.
Johnson considers the Super Bowl one of society's last collective viewing experiences. And with multiple generations all watching the same thing, it can be a minefield for ads. She doesn't think playing it too safe works, but she says there's just as many risks when an ad doesn't go far enough. And she points out, smartphones mean there's a lot of screens to consider.
You've got Gen Xers who are locked into the game, and then you want a piece of content, maybe a second screen experience that's going to resonate with Gen Z who's locked into their phones.
That explains why many of the ads come with a number of versions, and it's some of the reason behind why they're rolled out over multiple days. Content leading up to the Super Bowl is just as important, but Johnson says the giant sticker price applies directly to the big day.
A lot of people are asking, well, is it really worth it? And I would say it's 100% worth it. A violent yes. it is, because think about last year. It was over 123 million people watching. That's like second only to the moon landing.
It's also a lot of Doritos. But the ads aren't the only show within the big show. There's also the halftime show. To put it in context, the Super Bowl halftime show isn't that old. Before it became the spectacle we know today, it was more of a showcase, often featuring marching bands. But viewers were tuning out. And in 1992, a year showcasing Gloria Estefan and several Olympic ice skaters, a popular sketch comedy show threw down a challenge.
I remember so vividly that In Living Color comedy special.
Rob Sheffield is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone.
It was so audacious and daring for anybody to go up against the Super Bowl.
The episode on a competing network drew over 20 million viewers. Understandably, the NFL didn't like that. So the following year, it issued its own challenge.
The big change the next year comes, they brought in Michael Jackson.
The rest, they say, is history. And although the sample size is relatively small, we have enough to know the do's and don'ts of a Super Bowl halftime show.
The Super Bowl show is a huge audience. No matter how famous the artist is, they're playing to a lot of people who are not here for music.
He says one of the biggest pitfalls involves underestimating the breadth and depth of the audience. One example of that, February 7th, 2010.
When The Who played the halftime show, The Who treated it like it was their own show. And they didn't really seem connected to the surroundings.
Sheffield says Pete Townsend admitted later he had never seen a Super Bowl performance. And Townsend went on to say he had never actually watched a football game. In that case, knowing your audience is one thing. Remembering the sheer size of that audience is entirely another.
Bruno Mars was great, partly because he brought on a guest, the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Sheffield says Super Bowl 48 serves as one example of a super collaboration. Though every headliner has a lot of fans, there's very few that can command the entire Super Bowl audience. He points to Katy Perry teaming up with Lenny Kravitz, Shakira and Jennifer Lopez, and although Justin Timberlake appearing next to a hologram of Prince was a nice idea,
that definitely doesn't work. That doesn't go over so well.
There are examples of a single artist holding their own. Sheffield points to Diana Ross arriving by helicopter, the universal appeal of Paul McCartney, and of course, Super Bowl 41.
Yeah, the Prince performance is, I think, universally hailed as the greatest Super Bowl performance of all time. There was an element of Prince just doing whatever Prince wants to do as he goes along, and that's almost impossible to do in a Super Bowl setting.
Sheffield says almost impossible because he thinks it'll happen again. He points out that because the show is relatively new, most artists are still figuring it out. And he says it's only a matter of time before someone tops Prince.
But it's not just new stadiums fueling the business side of sports teams. Now it's often what's around the stadiums that has the sports industry's attention. Odyssey News reporter Holly Kwan is at Oracle Park in San Francisco.
Let's go Giants!
Oracle Park sounds very different in the off-season. Crews building new bars closer to the seats, new food choices reminiscent of old San Francisco.
We have a somewhat limited audience of baseball fans, and we want this to be more than a baseball park. We want it to be a ballpark that welcomes the broader community, and that means that what we do here has to include more than baseball. And when we talk about the food program by way of example, and you look around our concourses, whether it's, you know, Tony's Slice House, Tony's Pizza and the Slice House, or, you know, any number of the other concessions, even the Doggy Diner, which was inspired by, you know, a San Francisco institution. This is all part of how we evolve the ballpark, is introducing new things and making sure that it's an authentic representation of the community we exist within.
Giants Chief Operations and Experience Officer Alfie Felder started out as a Giants usher. He knows a thing or two about how to get fans in the stands. Five outdoor concerts already slated for summer, including Kendrick Lamar, Post Malone, and Shakira. Giants CEO Larry Bear has been touting the orange and black for over three decades. A numbers guy, he points out the yearly average attendance at the Giants' previous stadium, blustery Candlestick Park, was 1.5 million. To break even in their new digs, he needed twice that.
Where does the delta, the increase from 1.5 million fans at Candlestick to 3 million fans here, which we've done most of the years here, 3 million fans, where does that come from? Comes from people who are here for a family experience, a fun experience. They might like baseball, and we want them to grow to love baseball, but we might hook them in through other elements like a great family experience, food, music, the kids, the mascots, all the things that, so to get for that additional 1.5 million, which we would call the more casual fans, and that formula has worked. And, we'd want to extend that now as we talk about Mission Rock to, putting together a neighborhood.
From the rear of the ballpark, you look across McCovey Cove to what used to be a 30-acre parking lot. Now it's 1,000 workers inside Visa's gleaming 13-story global headquarters. Two completed towers of housing, restaurants, and bakeries moving their appliances in. Mission Rock is the Giants' public-private partnership to create a new neighborhood out of an abandoned rail yard.
I mean, if you look over there, we've got, work, Visa's headquarters, live, the Canyon building, the red building. Play, we've got the park, and you've got people, there's a biker, and you've got people biking and running and jogging, and, we'll be doing more of that in future phases in that same theme of live, work, play.
With phase one done, he hopes all four will be finished by the end of the decade. But why does a baseball group turn to real estate?
Over time, I think it's kind of how do you define what business you're in? And we define ourselves as, increasingly in the sports, media, entertainment, leisure time business, and also now real estate development, but I don't think of it as development as much as placemaking. So that can extend, outside the four walls here. you know, is there some other franchise that we might want to take a, you know, a look at? Are there attractions in San Francisco that we might want to help market? Now, we've done that in on occasional basis through Giants Enterprises, where we were partnered on the America's Cup. To extend into what our skill sets are, you know, which are increasingly beyond just putting on baseball games.
Right now, the ballpark is the bread and butter, so that's where Alfie Felder continues to create revenue opportunities, like the luxuriously private Gotham Club, hidden in plain sight above a public walkway.
The essence of this ability to sort of see behind the curtain and to be in a bit of a speakeasy space that nobody knows exists is exciting. And, you know, if you look, this literally is the out-of-town scoreboard here. You can sit at these benches above it and look out over the field, or as we walk into the bar, the ballpark's most beautiful bar, and then the scoreboard right behind it. And so, you know, if you know Fenway Park and the Green Monster and that manual scoreboard, this is the equivalent of being able to sit inside that manual scoreboard and then have a filtered view out to the field.
But with a waiting list years long, the so-called casual fan may have better luck outside at the stationary cable car.
What person doesn't step on a cable car and have that bring a smile to their face, right? That's just fun. And so a lot of it is just connecting people to all the fun that can be had here in so many different ways. It's looking out over this wall and taking a look around and seeing if you can see a seal popping in and out of the water, or, you know, on a different day, you know, there might be sailboats out there, and just watching that experience unfold.
The Giants' first home game of 2025 is April 4th.
This has been Big Games, Big Money, an Odyssey Conversation, produced by Michelle Fredrigill and Dennis Foley. You can get the best in news, sports, and talk from your favorite radio stations like this one, and more content like Odyssey Conversations anytime, anywhere on the free Odyssey app. For all of us at Odyssey News, I'm Dave Cohen.
Joining us today is Machina Fennett. She's an American Heart Association volunteer, an advocate for the Go Red for Women initiative. Sheena, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, glad to have you. This is Heart Health Month. We're halfway through February, but people need to know that Heart Health Month is very important, especially with the American Heart Association. And you in particular, you've got quite a story. First of all, I'm glad you're here. Like I said, February is Heart Health Month. Go Red for Women is a signature women's initiative. So tell us about what it's been about and why you're so adamant about people should know more as much as they can about it.
Yeah, sure, definitely. Go Red for Women is a source of credible, equitable health solutions for women at every age and every stage of life, every season of life.
Mm-hmm.
It really aims to create and increase awareness around women's heart health. And through my own journey, I learned that cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in women and takes more lives than all forms of cancer combined.
Wow.
I know it's even just every time I say that, it gives me goosebumps.
Yeah.
So truly, Go Red for Women, it's an amazing organization. And its goal is really to educate and empower women to take charge of their heart health through things like lifestyle changes and awareness, especially in February during Heart Month. And I think for so long, heart disease was always thought of as a man's disease.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm proof that cardiovascular disease does not discriminate. And there's such an underrepresentation of women in research, and the Go Red for Women movement strives to really close that gap.
That is fantastic. And again, it's been around for about over 20 years, I think. And I think, again, everyone wants to take care of their bodies. They, you know, you see all the health and fitness things, and people want to look at it like that. But people are kind of resistant to not go to the doctor on a regular basis just to check things that may be more dangerous, like you said, whether it's cancer or whether it's heart health and heart situations. Can you talk about cardiovascular disease in particular and how you found out that you had it?
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, and I think growing up, I kind of was just one of those women that thought, well, it's not really going to happen to me. It doesn't mm-hmm. run in my family. I live a pretty healthy lifestyle. I'm young and active. I do all the things that you're supposed to do.
Right.
But it still affected me. And so it was, just to kind of give you a little bit of the background of the story, it was October of 2020. And right around that time, I started to feel off. And I was lightheaded from time to time, very easily winded, really an overall feeling of just not being well.
By the way, you mentioned October 2020. Was this like, it was during the pandemic? Did you think maybe I have COVID?
You know, I don't think I thought I had COVID, but I knew something was wrong. I honestly right. thought it was maybe hormone related.
Okay.
Because I think as women, we mm-hmm. think, oh, okay, maybe that's what's making me feel different. Mm-hmm. And so I had kind of started down that path of trying to figure out what was going on. And the feelings, they persisted a couple weeks. And, you know, I'd made a doctor's appointment and done what I was supposed to do. And then it was October 13th. I'll never forget the day, October 13th, 2020. And we were really just having a normal day. My husband was traveling for work, so he was out of town. And I've got two boys. They're now 14 and 10. But at the time, we had just come home from soccer practice with mm-hmm. them. And I had rushed to get them to bed because it was past their bedtime. And once I got them to bed, I was in my kitchen looking at my calendar just to see what we had on the agenda for the next day. And I start feeling all of these same symptoms I had been feeling, but they were so much stronger. And I could feel my heart racing so incredibly fast that it felt like it was beating outside of my body. And it was kind of one of those moments where I knew something was about to happen. Mm-hmm. So I tried to sit down on the kitchen floor and I actually ended up collapsing in the kitchen and I passed out.
Oh, wow. Who found you?
Yeah. Thankfully, I woke back up by myself.
Wow.
So I am very, very lucky. And
yes.
what we know now, that's a miracle.
It really is. You could have been behind the steering wheel of your car.
I know. I mean, and there's so many what ifs. I think I was exactly where I needed to be when that happened. I don't know if the impact of me falling on the ground kind of helped get my heart back into the right rhythm. I'm mm-hmm. not sure what, but I woke back up and obviously knew, okay, well, this isn't normal. So I went to the emergency room that night.
Did you take yourself?
And they ran. I'm sorry.
Did you drive yourself?
I didn't. I had a neighbor come and stay with my kids because uh-huh. they were asleep. And then I had another neighbor drive me to the emergency room.
Wow.
And so once we got there, they took it very seriously and ran every test that they could. They checked my heart. They checked for a heart attack and everything came back normal. And so they were kind of stumped and they said, we're not really sure why you passed out. Perhaps it's stress and anxiety related. We're not sure, but everything checked out. So you're free to go home. And they did tell me follow up with a cardiologist just to be safe. And so I did. I followed up with a cardiologist probably a couple days later. And I was told the same thing, that I was fine. I was healthy. He didn't run any other tests. He said if the symptoms continued, then we could run some tests in the future.
I know this is just making your head spin because you're like, I don't feel well.
Yeah, exactly. I was so frustrated at that doctor's appointment because I was telling him, listen, I know my body. I know when something's off. I don't feel well. I was 38 at the time. A healthy 38-year-old doesn't just pass out
right.
in her kitchen for no reason. And I was basically just told I was probably stressed or anxious.
Hmm.
So I left that appointment very frustrated. and knew that I wasn't going to get anywhere with that particular person. So I went ahead and made my third doctor's appointment with another cardiologist, and he fit me in right away, and he put a heart monitor on me that day, which now we know was truly my saving grace, because after wearing it for probably just a day or so, it alerted him that my heart was going in and out of ventricular tachycardia.
Oh my goodness. So it was not even like a heart murmur. It wasn't like a, tell me some symptoms. Cause I know people who are listening are like, wait a minute, some people might be touching their hearts right now saying, what did it seem like? Or I know you had that monitor on it, but what was different?
Yeah. I could feel palpitations or flutters.
Okay. Flutter.
Kind of what my heart felt like, but it also kind of took my breath away a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same symptoms that I was feeling before I passed out, where I was a little dizzy, a little off, just lightheaded, which, you know, you can attribute those symptoms to a lot of different things.
Sure.
But a lot of times it's your heart too. And so it alerted him that I was going in and out of VTAC. And I remember when he called me, which, you know, your cardiologist does not just call you out of the blue unless there's something very wrong. And I was in the carpool line to get my two kids from school. And he calls me and he says, Sheena, what are you doing right now? And I said, well, I'm sitting in the car. I'm waiting to get my kids from school. Why? And he said, your heart is going into a very dangerous arrhythmia. You have to leave for the carpool line and go to the emergency room right now.
Wow. Let me slow down right here, because this is just an amazing story. In other words, he calls you and you're just waiting in the carpool line in your car. You're not working out. You're not doing anything that's like extracurricular. You're not doing anything stressful. You're just sitting in your car.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. I was just sitting in my car waiting for my kids.
Wow. And so then what happened?
Well, you know, and I think a lot of moms can relate when someone tells you to leave the carpool line or leave your kids.
You don't know. You're like, no, I can't leave my kids.
Yeah, you give them a little bit of pushback.
Not after school. Yeah.
Well, let me grab my kids.
Right. Take them to the neighbors or something, right?
Yeah. Make them a snack. No, I said, let me grab my kids, take them home, and I'll make my way to the hospital. And he told me, you really don't have time for that. He said, you have to go now. And it really kind of was a little bit of an internal battle at that moment, too, because I had been searching for answers.
Right.
Right. I wanted to know what was going on with my body. Well, finally, someone is telling me something's happening. We know what it is. It's very dangerous. We need to help you now. And it's almost like I didn't believe it. You know, so it was kind of that internal struggle. But I went to we made our way to the emergency room.
Okay, you said, hold on. You're leaving out a good part. You said, did you have your kids with you?
No, I did not.
Who had the kids?
Had
people want to know these things. Who had the kids?
Up from school.
Okay, good.
Whew. Yeah. Yeah, we had someone else pick them up from school. But, you know, my mind was with them. My heart was, picked them up every day from school. So for me not to be there and for me not to have already told them, hey, somebody else is going to pick you up, I knew they would be very worried.
Oh, I understand. I've got three kids myself. And one of the things I loved doing when they were in pre-K, elementary school and middle school, was picking them up just from school and hearing the stories about how their day went. So I know how that attachment, you're like, I can't leave them at school. They're going to be worried about me too. And
exactly.
So you got somebody.
I didn't know what to tell them.
Yeah.
I can't tell at that.
You don't want to scare them.
I had a first grader and a fourth grader.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell them the doctor said there's something wrong with my heart. I'm in the emergency room. They wouldn't understand. They wouldn't know what to do with that information.
Right. So,
you know, so there were a lot of things going through my mind at that time.
Yeah. So then you go to the emergency room.
I did. Happened? So I went to the emergency room and I ended up staying there about a week. And I was there about a week. The first few days, they ran every test you can think of. I thought I was probably going to be there a few hours.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe this might take 3 or 4 hours and then I go home and lay down.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. But they really couldn't figure out what was causing my heart to go into these dangerous arrhythmias. And so I was really being monitored for a good amount of that time, along with the tests that they were running. And I think it was on day four, they concluded that I'm considered high risk for sudden cardiac death. And they would need to surgically implant an ICD, which is a defibrillator, into my body to protect my heart from these dangerous symptoms ever happening again, and that I would be on medication for the rest of my life to try to stabilize my heart.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so let's backtrack a little bit. So you're in the hospital for 4 days, and your husband knows all about this, and I know he's worried to death as well. Were the kids coming to visit you? I'm trying to figure if you had any normalcy, because you had no news on what they're learning about you yet. For 4 days, that's a lot of stress.
It was a lot of stress. We tried to keep it as normal for the kids as we could. And so as much as I wanted my husband with me at night and through the night, because that's really the scariest time, because that's when your mind goes to all the what ifs.
Yeah, it wanders, and you're like, I wish there was a little couch over here. I wish there was another bed over there on the other side. And for him to just be there.
As much as I wanted him with me, we made the decision that it was best for the kids that he be at home with them in the evenings and at night.
Yeah.
So
because he was there to keep them calm, you had the doctors and nurses to keep you calm.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, as a parent, no matter what you're going through, your kids are still, they're your number one thought. And so we didn't know what was happening with me. And honestly, I didn't know what to tell them. And I knew if I saw them, I would break down.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be able to hold it together.
Right.
And I needed to hold it together for them and for myself, because I knew I needed to be strong that week in the hospital. And when someone tells you you're high risk for sudden cardiac death, I mean, what do you do with information like that? How do you process that?
Just amazing.
What do you tell your kids?
This is so, Sheena, I got to tell everybody your name again, because this story is just too amazing. Sheena Fannin, she's an American Heart Association volunteer and advocate for the Go Red for Women initiative. This is Heart Health Month, and this is her amazing story of how she found out about she had cardiovascular disease around her heart. And so day four, you find out that you're going to be on meds the rest of your life, that they have to put a defibrillator?
Yes.
In your body?
Yes.
How did you grasp that?
You know, I don't think you really do until it's over. I think I was in quote unquote survival mode.
Right.
At that time.
And it
was,
I
remember telling them, do whatever you need to do, but I have to get home to my kids.
Right.
You know, the most important thing to me and why I am here is to be a mom and a wife. Nothing brings me more joy than that. So do what you need to do, but make sure I get home to my family.
So that happens on day four. You're still in the hospital, and tell us what was happening next. What were the next steps, and how did you tell your husband?
When the doctor told us what they thought the plan needed to be, my husband was there. And so we were told together, and I had my parents on speakerphone. And remember, it was during the time of the pandemic, so I couldn't have everybody in the hospital room with me. So my parents were on speakerphone when the doctor came in to talk to us. I'm very close to my sister. She's a physician as well. I would have her on speakerphone as well. So we were all trying to circle around each other. They were trying to be there for me as best they could without being able to physically be there. But my husband was in the room with me. And you know, when they told us that they would have to implant a defibrillator, I don't think I understood what that fully meant right? Because right. like I said, I feel like I was just kind of in survival mode. It's like, do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. But they gave us that information. I got to choose what size defibrillator I wanted implanted into my body, which is a very strange thing to do. Because the larger the device, the longer the life of the battery. But I have a very small frame, and so a larger device would be very uncomfortable for me.
Right.
So my doctor suggested a smaller one for me, which I will change out, which they will change out every 7 years or so.
Mm-hmm. So you got the defibrillator. I'm just trying to figure out how you're wrapping your mind around this. And again, you're alive. You're an advocate, of course, but I'm just trying to figure out how your life sort of changed. I mean, you were already doing, quote unquote, the right things. You were living a regular life, but you were taking care of yourself. It wasn't like, well, you know, I kind of let myself go. No, you were doing what normal people do. I'm talking about people who have access to regular things and was living a regular life. So after, you know, they do the defibrillator and they say, here are the meds you have to take. How does that change your life beyond the advocacy part? I'm talking about your day to day at home with the kids and your husband.
Yeah.
And your family.
I was really grateful to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was saved because of how healthy I was. Right. And because I led such a healthy lifestyle, I think that's truly what saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
But coming home from the hospital and just having surgery and being told what I was told, I knew immediately I wanted to connect with the American Heart Association because I felt like if this happened to me, I definitely think it happened for a reason and there is good that can come from it.
Yes.
And I knew the American Heart Association could help me find that good. And you know, in the back of my mind, I just kept thinking if this could happen to me and I was so healthy, it could really happen to anyone else. And I want to be able to share my story in hopes of helping another woman who doesn't think heart disease will affect her the same way I didn't think it would affect me.
Let me repeat what you said at the top of the show. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in women, more than all forms of cancer combined. And the fact is, most women are not aware of that. They just don't know that. And this is Heart Health Month. And I'm so grateful that you're sharing your story. And you live in the Plano area, right? Plano, Texas?
I do. Yes.
So I'm sure, you know, how long ago did this happen, by the way?
This was at the
2020.
End of 2020.
Right. So 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago.
Yeah.
Your life changed, and again, you're an advocate, but I'm curious about the day-to-day stuff that you do. Are you still doing the exact same things that you used to do? Because you're a very healthy person. I'm just trying to figure out if there were any kind of restrictions in your life that you're grateful for because you're still alive, or do you still maintain the same healthy lifestyles? Or you can still travel. You can still do all the things you have to do. I'm just kind of curious because, again, you're an exception. And again, because of your grace and the fact that you know it could happen to anyone, you're out here spreading the word.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. My day to day has not changed significantly.
Good.
There are a few things that I'm unable to do. I will never be able to run a marathon, which I'm okay with that. I still am active. I still go to the gym at least 3 or 4 times a week. I've just modified the way that I work out a little bit, as in I'm not allowed to lift any heavy weights above my head.
Okay.
Because the defibrillator has wires that are attached to my heart, and we need to just be careful to make sure that those don't move or are loosened. So, you know, I have lost some range of motion in my left arm because of where the defibrillator is placed.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely have, you know, pain in that area, but that comes along with it. I truly am so grateful to be here. And all of those are just reminders that I made it, I survived. And I'm so thankful that we have technology in place or, you know, devices in place to be able to help us live longer.
Mm-hmm. In fact, like I said, the work that you're doing, especially this year, 2025, the Go Red for Women movement is focusing on heart disease and strokes in women, maternal health altogether. Did it affect you mentally at all? Because, you know, everybody's really into mental health awareness and advocacy with that. Because, again, you know, there's a lot of people who are more isolated nowadays. They spend a lot of time on social media. And I was just kind of curious if this made you mentally stronger, knowing that you overcame this or you're able to deal with this and you were fortunate enough to survive this. Or did you have any, you know, times where you felt bad for yourself?
Yeah, you know, great question. A little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I think the gravity of all of it hit me maybe a month after I had come home from the hospital. Because when I got home, I just thought, okay, well, I'm going to jump back into life as I used to know it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do everything I did before. I'm going to wake up early. I'm going to make my kids their lunches. I'm going to drive them to school. I'm going to do everything I used to do because I don't want them to think mom is different.
Right.
Mom can't do what she used to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I kind of jumped right back into it. And that did help me heal emotionally and mentally as well. But the gravity of knowing that there is a device in my body that could potentially shock my heart back into a normal rhythm, there's a lot of feelings around that, right? Like all the what, and it hasn't. Mm-hmm. I've never been shocked by the device, thank goodness. My mm-hmm. heart has always gone back into a normal rhythm on its own. So the device has not had to kick in. But I would say that first year was pretty terrifying.
I was going to say scary.
Yeah. I mean, even just to go to sleep at night, I would sometimes wake up in the middle of the night thinking, oh my gosh, did the device just shock me? Or, you know, mm-hmm. like, did I pass out again? And I was woken up because the device had to do what it's supposed to do, or just all of those things, right? Like mm-hmm. there is now a machine inside my body that's going to shock me at some point if it needs to. How do you grasp that? But I put a lot of work into accepting it, being grateful for it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't easy for me to do that. It took time, but I focused on my mental health by meditating. I read a lot of self-help books. I listen to podcasts. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to in a situation like this, you know, because things could have gone very differently for me. And this is such a reminder that no one is guaranteed tomorrow.
Right. You know what? I'm really enjoying your story. I mean, it's an amazing story. And it reminds me of how I think in October, everybody's pretty much aware of breast cancer awareness and breast cancer survivors. The cardiovascular survivors, the CVD survivors, you guys have a heck of a story as well. And that's why I'm glad this month of February is Heart Health Month. And you guys are able to tell your stories too, including on this show. I know that the American Heart Association in North Texas, you guys have a lot of different events going on year round where people can get together and bond and share their stories and enlighten other members of their families or their friends. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. The American Heart Association North Texas hosts some amazing events every year to celebrate the work of the Go Red for Women mission.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a part of an organization that wants to attend those or any future events, you can reach out to the American Heart Association, your local American Heart Association, and they can get you plugged in. There's so many opportunities to volunteer or donate, and a lot of that can be found at goredforwomen.org. They've got a lot of valuable information on there on how you can get plugged into all of that.
You know, it's great when you can share your story or you listen to others who've had some of the same kind of stories, or they can kind of open up and say, you know what, I've been through that too. Or, oh, wow. It's kind of like, you know, here in Texas, you're somewhere on the East Coast or the West Coast or wherever, Chicago. Oh, you're from Texas? I'm from Texas too. Really? Oh, and then all of a sudden you kind of open up and you kind of, you know, you feel better because it's somebody that's been through some things like you or from the place that you're from. Is that what kind of happens sometimes?
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. It really is such an amazing organization, and its mission is to save lives. So anyone can get involved. And I think one of the big points or takeaways also is for everyone to learn CPR.
Yes.
Because could truly save someone's life.
And that is not an understatement. I'm serious as a heart attack. That is not an understatement because you just never know where it comes in handy. And again, it's just something that you just happen to know and you're ready and you're there. You hear stories all the time. Somebody's on the airplane. Is there a doctor on the plane? And somebody just happens to know some CPR and saves a life.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And, you know, the biggest thing that I've taken away from all of this and what I really try to spread is for women to know their numbers.
Yes.
And trust your gut. If I hadn't trusted my gut, or I had listened to the first doctor that I had gone to, I probably wouldn't be here today.
Exactly.
So you know your body. And I think it's so important for us to take our health into our own hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sheena, let me tell you something. It has been a pleasure having you on the show. Your story is absolutely amazing. You are the perfect advocate for the Go Red for Women movement. The initiative, the American Heart Association, and volunteering, the whole nine yards. Sheena, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And anybody else, if you want more information, go to goredforwomen.org. And thank you all for joining us on Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold. So long, everybody.